1987 Precinct Podcast. This is the only podcast in the world dedicated to Ed McBain's 87th Precinct mysteries, the genre-defining series of police procedural novels, which began in 1956 with Cop Hater and ended in 2005 with the novel Fiddlers. There were 55 books in the series, and today's podcast is all about book number 18. Sharpen your tools, everyone, for a nice clean cut with Axe. To review the book, I'm joined by two people the police are keen to talk to about the incident, Mr. Morgan Brown.
Hello.
And Mr. Stephen Royston.
Chop, chop.
And here's your usual reminder that you can find us across all social media and podcast apps as Hark87Podcast. And if you'd like to drop us perhaps $3 for a digital coffee via PayPal, you can visit ko-fi.com, ko-fi.com/harkpodcast, and you can donate towards running the show. And you can use the hashtag LitHappens if you want to find other literature and books-based podcasts online. That's the written bit out of the way. It's all downhill from here. What I thought we might do in this episode, fellas, is a bit of an overview of the series. Mm-hmm. So we're 18 books in, and it starts in 56. We've reached 1964 with this book. So for the benefit of perhaps a new listener, should there be any, hello, new listener, could we describe what the 87th Precinct series is all about? What is it?
Well, it's a series that details the daily work of a busy police force in a New York-like city on the east coast of the USA.
Yeah. Specifically the detective division of that precinct.
Well, absolutely, yeah. None of your uniformed cops there, particularly, although they crop up occasionally.
Yeah. And it's in the mould of a police procedural.
Absolutely. So we're very specifically following, well, most of the time at least, specifically following the actual kind of ins and outs of, like, what actually happens during a police investigation. So,
yeah. And like that runs right down to the forms they use for filling in incident reports, the forensic details, the method of catching, i.e. taking the calls in the first place, who's on shifts and this sort of thing. All very administrative, which might not sound exciting from the outside, but actually gives it a very real feel.
It's a new level of realism for the detective novel, really. It's taken away from romantic private investigator swinging whiskey from a bottle in his drawer and following gangsters about, or some kind of high society gentleman in a mansion, gathering everyone in the drawing room to tell them who committed the murder. It's definitely taken crime literature back to real life, really, which is...
Yeah, because in most other literature at the time, the police were either incompetent or corrupt.
Yeah, they were there to be Lestrade.
Yeah, you know, totally kind of getting in the way of solving it, whereas here they're absolutely central to the stories and the resolution of those stories. And there's a fairly fixed cast, although that's taken a little bit of time to bed down who that fixed cast is. And then there's other characters who come and go and disappear for quite a while and then suddenly come back as though they've never been away.
As an important point as well, it's a gestalt hero. So although we have Steve Carell, who's maybe the most often featured detective, the hero is actually the entire squad, so... It's not just a single sort of heroic figure amidst a crowd of incompetents or anything like that.
But what's quite nice is all the different detectives that feature in this as part of this hero are individual characters. So they aren't just plain undistinguishable cops. They all have particular traits and behaviours, and that includes being bad cops occasionally.
Absolutely, yeah.
Some of them.
It is an attempt to realistically, to some extent at least, portray a police force. So while there are good cops who are doing their job, even the good cops sometimes have their negative moments. I think in the book we're about to discuss, there's some racial profiling.
Yes.
But then there are also cops who are plain bad, really, who the others have to work with. And we see that working relationship as well, which is really fascinating, I think.
And another curiosity as well, which is one of the good things about the series, is they're all set at a particular time. They're all topical matters when they were set from 56 to 64 in this, but curiously, none of the characters ever really get any older.
Oh, they do very gradually, possibly. Like, life moves on a little bit, but...
Like dog years in reverse kind of thing. So, even at this point, you probably wouldn't... Well, you certainly don't pick it up reading them once a month. I suppose if you were thinking, I started reading those McBain's 10 years ago and nobody's ever got any older, you know, they still got the same boss and whatnot, but... Yeah, once you, you know...
Which makes it
kind of a
very easy to pick any one of them up.
Absolutely.
Indeed, you're not
laden down by a backlog of history, although it is there if you know where to look, and it will be referred to. You're not sort of believing that you've been watching the same cops do the same job for 30 years by the mid-80s or whatever.
Yeah, you know, 2005, Steve Carell must have been about 90.
He would have been getting on. So that was just a little brief overview of the series. I would imagine everyone knows this anyway, but it's worth restating because it's an addictive series. It's got common elements that make you come back over and over again. And one of the things we often discuss is the things in the book, what we call the 87th Precinct bingo sheet.
The weather.
Things like the weather descriptions of the city being anthropomorphized or whatever. Behaviours, characters, things like that, which we will refer to. But we've come to a fairly interesting book, which we'll get to in a second. I was asked a couple of questions, but one particularly, in a general sense, not necessarily about the 87th Precinct, but we were asked, who was McBain's favourite author?
Ooh.
And if you read in the 87th Precinct, I think it's quite hard to tell.
Mm.
He clearly comes from an American tradition, comes off the back of detective fiction. I mean, who would you guess at if you didn't sort of know?
I don't know. Do you actually know?
I've got some information.
Did you ask Otto?
I didn't ask him, actually, no. But this is discoverable information. But
yeah, it's... I know there have been prior standalone police procedurals, but that kind of detective novel was fairly unprecedented, wasn't it? So,
yeah.
I don't know, would you guess like Chandler or...
Hammett.
Yeah.
Exactly right. Straight off the first two mystery writers off the bat, Raymond Chanyel? No one's heard of Raymond Chanyel.
He's underrated, I think. Yeah.
He needs his own podcast, I would say.
My apologies to Raymond Chandler there and to Raymond Chanyel. Both of them, sorry. So Chandler and Hammett, Dashiell Hammett, and also James M. Cain.
Mm.
These were the mystery ones that were sort of named.
Not read any of his.
As inspirations for McBain, particularly.
Yeah.
Of course, McBain's the pseudonym for Evan Hunter, and his other influences he stated, and I found this in a reproduction of an answer he gave to someone on a blog years ago, was also Hemingway and F. Scott Fitzgerald. So the great American authors of the 20th century.
That makes sense, yeah.
Who presumably brought more of an influence to bear on Evan Hunter's standalone work.
Hmm.
But I've not read masses of that, so it's quite hard to say.
I think, like, sort of Hemingway with the sort of direct, kind of compact prose and these sort of punchy little sentences, you can definitely see the
Have you read much Hemingway?
Only a couple of bits, but I can see that would make sense.
Yeah. So... There was a little question there. That was submitted by my brother.
Aww.
Who bought his first McBain books in the wild when we were in London on the weekend.
Yes.
So we found...
Yeah, I'm in a headlock at the time.
Fortunately, the addictive nature of these books is such that it doesn't take much once they've got their hooks into you to make you want to collect them and read them.
Very true.
And Gary is... now reading them in order as well, so...
It's the only way to read them.
Yeah.
It's exactly how I didn't read them.
Well, that's why we're doing this now, so we can remedy that, isn't it?
Absolutely.
So we're going to move on to our contextual information.
Ooh.
We might even get to the book at some point.
Maybe.
These 1964 factoids.
Yeah. So, I can tell you that the copyright registration for the book was 11th of September 1964...
When was the last book previous to this? We seem to have jumped about a year.
It's a year, yeah.
What was he doing in that time?
Well, I can tell you a little bit of what he was doing in that time. Between this and the last 87th Precinct book, he produced a novel as Evan Hunter called Budwing, which is one of his big literary successes.
Indeed.
And became a film called Mr. Budwing. and I think I'll save information about that and perhaps do it as a side pod or something, because cool. I'd really like to watch the film. But that was a big Evan Hunter literary novel.
Mm-hmm.
He also wrote a play called The Easter Man or A Race of Hairy Men.
Excellent. Mm.
I'm not entirely sure how much success he had as a playwright. I don't know that it was his finest work, or certainly wasn't seen as.
With titles like that, though, how could he go wrong?
With A Race of Hairy Men, yeah, I don't know. One thing I also know he did, in 1964, in July, he appeared on a programme called The World of Books on the BBC Home Service.
Yes.
Oof. As Evan Hunter being interviewed about Budwing, and as Ed McBain being interviewed about Like Love.
Oh, right.
Cool.
Book before.
Did he like divide it up and come back doing a funny voice?
I would hope so.
I really hope so.
This, I assume this exists in the archive somewhere. Sadly, I can't find a recording of it. I'll have to contact the BBC and see if there's any way to get hold of it. Or they might have deleted it like they did with so much of their stuff.
Indeed.
So let's get into the usual thing, the quiz of 1964. Oh. So what do you reckon was in the charts around September 1964?
The Beatles.
Funnily enough, not in the top five in either America or the UK.
The outrageous. I've been waiting to say that for ages.
Follow that thought, Steve-O.
The Kinks. How do you follow it?
Well, by thinking of a song.
You really
got right. Yeah. Oh, sorry.
Number one in
I thought
the
it wasn't the Kinks, but I had to follow that.
The Clinks?
The Kinks.
No, it was You Really Got Me by the Kinks was number one in the UK.
Fair enough.
I mean, the Beatles were in the charts. They were...
The Hollies.
Dominating a lot of them, but...
The Hollies would have been thereabouts by then too, I'd imagine, but maybe not right there at the exact time.
No, not in the top fives of either here or America.
Hmm.
Our top five was You Really Got Me with Kinks, Have I the Right by Honeycombs...
Oh, yes. Have I the right to hold you?
Oh, that's a passionate song, that, isn't
it? Isn't it just?
Hasn't that got drums a bit like Dave Clark Five?
Yes, proper stomper, isn't it? That's the one.
Oh, I don't know this song. From the look on your faces, it sounds brilliant.
I reckon you'd know if you heard it.
There's one word that would describe it as a bit of a stomper.
It is a stomper.
A stomper. I'll bear that. We'll listen to it later. Number three was I Won't Forget You by Jim Reeves. That joke writes itself.
It does.
I Wouldn't Trade You for the World by The Bachelors. I don't know that one.
No, nor I.
And The Crying Game by Dave Berry.
Oh, yeah, fair enough.
The Beatles were at number 10 in the charts at that point with Hard Day's Night. But they'd been at number one and they'd been there for 9 weeks.
Yes,
so,
indeed.
So there. In America, number one was House of the Rising Sun by The Animals.
Oh, yeah, they were massive in the States.
They were importing sort of... blues back to America.
Yeah. Some lads from Newcastle importing Lead Belly to the States is crazy, isn't it?
It's a very strange thing, but a lot of that cultural exchange... Oh no, you know what, I'm not going to talk about that. That's my other life as a music person, popular music historian thing. Where Did Our Love Go by The Supremes?
Oh, stormer.
Because by the Dave Clark Five.
Again, I think they made more impact in the States than they did here, really.
Dave Clark's to be believed, he was bigger than the Beatles in the States.
Yeah, with his live footage with Beatles audiences edited in.
Yeah.
Outrageous.
They were followed at number four by Everybody Loves Somebody by Dean Martin. So nice. A bit of a smoothie in there.
Mm-hmm.
And a song called Bread and Butter by the New Beats. Don't know that.
I like bread and butter.
Oh, I do know it then.
I like toast and jam. Is that the one, do you think?
I like croissants and cakes and other products made with wheat.
That's the one. Those are the exact lyrics, I believe.
So I did know it. The winner of the Best Picture in 1964 was My Fair Lady.
Oh, right.
So who do you think won Best Actor?
Rex Harrison, surely.
Rex Harrison.
For that speak singing.
We could do the rest of the podcast in Rex Harrison's voice. As if he sang a song.
But I've grown accustomed to her face. She almost makes the name again.
It was a very strange... I mean, it's brilliant, Rex Harrison, but it's a very strange performance. Well, come on, let's get it out of the way. Let's get it out of the way. Two Carry On films in 1964.
Oh,
here we go.
Oh.
Two quite good ones, I think.
I always say the wrong one, so...
You've been pitching camping for a while and I still don't think we're there yet.
Sergeant, is that one?
You keep doing that every time. That was the first one.
I like guessing that one. Was that the first one?
Yes, you say that every time as well.
Do I?
Yeah.
Carry On Milkman.
Still doesn't exist.
How did they miss that one?
I know. It's so obvious. Would have thought that would be full of all sorts of
random behaviour. See, I've seen
behavior.
So few of them that... carry on at least tax what? Inspector.
Carry on tax inspector.
Carry on motorway.
Oh, imagine that. It's... Well, there's one of the big epic colour ones.
Cleopatra?
Carry on Cleo.
Oh, there we go. Yes.
And one of the down-to-earth black and white ones.
Camping.
That's colour and a bit later, I think.
All right.
Carry on Spying. Ooh, which is done in reaction to the fact that the James Bond films come out. So
not sure I've ever heard of that one.
It's quite good, actually. I seem to remember Bernard Cribbins has quite a good part in that.
Of course.
You know you're in safe hands if Bernie's got a...
Who was the spy?
Role.
Cribbins?
I think Cribbins is one of the spies, as is Kenneth Williams.
Of course.
All hilarity ensues. I don't think I've ever seen it all the way through, but it's... Yeah, that basically comes off the back of James Bond being a big cultural phenomenon at the time. So, like, Goldfinger was a massive hit that year.
Of course.
Yeah.
As was... From Russia with Love, certainly as they went over to America. Hard Day's Night, obviously a big movie for the Beatles, one of my favourite films. Mary Poppins.
I think the sequel due shortly.
Yes, the trailer for the sequel came out the other day.
I think you'll find Bed Knobs and Broomsticks was released a long, long time ago.
That's true, as a side fact.
That's a sequel to Mary Poppins.
It's not a sequel to Mary
Poppins. It is. I think you will find it is.
Okay, you...
Might not have Mary Poppins in it, but it's still a
sequel. Well, it's still essentially the same film. It's some live action and some animation. I like Bedknobs and Broomsticks. But yeah, the sequel to Mary Poppins is coming out at Christmas. I watched the trailer the other day and cried a little bit because I really like Mary Poppins and it makes me cry. Because I'm a big softy.
Are there any cameos from...
From someone such as Dick Van Dyke?
Yeah.
Maybe there is.
Oh, seriously?
Yeah.
Oh, my lord.
Excellent. Well, he's in the trailer, yeah.
Is he?
Yeah.
Crikey.
Julie Andrews isn't in it, I don't
think. Isn't she?
No. Hmm. Anyway, Hammer Horror Films.
Oh.
There's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, I think, in that year.
Well, we'll be getting them.
Are they actually into horror territory yet?
Yeah, these are mainly horror, I think.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, we're still a couple of years off them bringing Dracula back.
Yeah. Hmm.
That was 66, I would think.
They haven't brought back Frankenstein yet, no.
Maybe they have Morgan Brown.
Revenge of Frankenstein.
No, he's not revenging yet.
Frankenstein.
He's monster. No, Frankenstein as... The Curse of Frankenstein.
Frankenstein's motorway.
Frankenstein's... Is
Frankenstein created woman.
No, it's Evil of Frankenstein.
Oh, Evil of Frankenstein. See, I used to... Once upon a time, I would have known all this. Yeah, Evil of Frankenstein.
And there was one of the Mummy films.
Blood from the Mummy's Tomb?
No.
Revenge of the Mummy? No. What is it?
Curse of the Mummy's Tomb.
Was it Curse Frankenstein, did it? I don't know.
Well,
the blank of can, blank.
Yeah, you can be excused with Hammer horror films.
Curse, claw,
just like
blood. Revenge, blood.
It's just got three little baskets with words and they pick out.
And this year we are making it's like the draw for the football. It's just someone turning a tombola and picking out words.
Yeah, that'd be a good way. Yeah,
they also did The Gorgon.
Oh, I was going to say The Gorgon. I remember The Gorgon. Yeah,
and one called Nightmare, just Nightmare, and one called Devil Ship Pirates.
Oh yeah, I've never seen that.
Nightmare, sadly, I assume not the film that was a precursor of the series featuring Traegard, the Dungeon Master.
Oh, no, sadly not. Talk about British ephemera, that's a whole new level if you're talking about Nightmare with a K.
Why are we talking about that?
Because Hammer Horror film was called Nightmare.
Oh!
But it's got nothing to do with Nightmare.
Oh, right.
Sorry.
Sadly.
I'm not deliberately setting it off like that.
Talking about stomping music. Yeah.
Had a bit of an Iron Maiden kind of bad beat to it, didn't it?
Yeah, Iron Maiden meets Dave Clark 5 meets...
meets Tolkien.
Yeah.
Yeah, with ELP watching from the wings.
Yeah, it is a bit ELP-like, isn't it? Keith Emerson would have been very happy he penned that one.
If you've joined us to hear about Ed McBain books, I do apologise. We will get round to it. So, it was a big year politically because in 1964 we had a general election in this country. Harold Wilson becomes the Prime Minister. We go from a Conservative government to a Labour government. Quite a narrow margin of victory.
It was, yeah. That's why they had another general election in 66.
Yeah, and to sort of solidify the vote, wasn't it? Uh-huh. And in America, there was the Democratic landslide where the Democrats come in and Lyndon B. Johnson becomes president. And so both him and Harold Wilson were leaders for quite a long while, I think.
Until 1970,
most
old
of the
Harold.
60s, wasn't it? Harold? And there's not much really to... I mean, there's always stuff to talk about TV, but two big ones for the UK are Top of the Pops.
Yes.
Started in 1964. That was a really big, important pop show with lots of bands performing live. It was a chart rundown show, essentially, wasn't it? That was a huge part of our growing up.
Absolutely.
And very sad when that ended.
So how many years after Ready, Steady, Go was that then?
Contemporary.
What after?
Yeah, about the same time, weren't they?
Maybe slightly after, and maybe as a reaction to Ready, Steady, Go, but it was close.
There are other people who are scholars of such things, but yeah, we're all around the same time. There's quite a few things.
Yeah, the 6-5 special and a few other bits like
Top
that.
Top of the Pops was the one that lasted.
Mm.
And also Match of the Day starts in 1964. Right, okay. The football scores programme that I...
Highlights, yeah.
Not really bothered about. You've probably watched hours of in your life, I'm sure.
Well, a staple of British television, I suppose, as much as anything else is.
So, shall we get on to the book?
I suppose.
Well, before we do that, we'll just take a quick break to advertise one of our friends.
Do you love books and booze? Do you like themed food? Do you like a mixture of high and lowbrow? Well then, welcome to Loaded Literature. We're your hosts. I'm Victoria.
I'm Hale.
And I'm Anya. This podcast began as a book club that expanded beyond our reading room. We cover one book in a month and break it down by analysis, background context, and adaptions, all of which will be paired with alcohol and food.
So please, come join our book club. Episodes air Wednesday at 10 a.m. Pacific Time, wherever you listen to podcasts. You can find us on social media at loadedliteraturepodcast.com, Loaded Lit Pod on Twitter, or Loaded Literature on Instagram. We all have our own individual social media, so please follow us there as well, and come join the conversation.
So here we are in 1964 with the novel Axe, or if you live in the UK, Axe. You would have heard the silent E there.
Important distinction there, yeah.
Well, definitely. This is what one thing I will, you know, remain proud about is, as British readers, we get more letters of McBain because of the word Axe being spelt correctly. And if we factor that in, so words like colour are spelt with the extra letter as well, we get so much more McBain for our money.
A lot more value, definitely.
May I have general impressions first off, you guys? What do you think of this one?
Sounds like a character, that, doesn't it? General impressions.
General impressions.
Don't remember him. My general impression would be this is a... perhaps a more traditional whodunit in the story arc sense. Perhaps less sideshowy stuff. Perhaps less dual plotting. It's pretty much some guys ended up with an axe encrusted in his head. And let's find out who did it, really.
Yeah, it's
no street gangs, no...
Yeah, there's very little
sort of like colour. Outside. Yeah, exactly the word I was looking for. Yeah, it's kind of meat and potatoes crime novel stuff, isn't it?
It is.
Gets in there, gets the job done.
And you wonder whether he like a conscious effort of, full. You know, it's 100%. Let's solve the crime. Really, there's a few.
I wonder whether it's one of the shorter ones in this period because it's only a. 140, it's less than 140 pages in the version I've got, and presumably the ones you've got as well, and only 10 chapters. They usually run a few chapters more than that, even if they run, say, 30 pages more or something. It is very straightforward. And I was wondering, I put a call out for opinions on this, and I got a couple back from some of our regular contributors who suggested that it was boring.
Aw, that's a little harsh.
Possibly. A dud of a story was one of the phrases. Am I reading a McBain? Where's the snap and cheek? And someone else saying tedious indeed.
I understand where people are coming from. I think, you know, people are maybe being a little bit harsh in their appraisal of this novel. I'm sure once we get Kenneth fired up, we'll find out where we stand on this, but...
I think I understand where those opinions come from. off the back of some of the recent ones.
Yeah.
And the run in general. This is, if this was a TV episode, this would be a sort of solid mid-series episode that keeps the story moving forward but doesn't necessarily do anything explosive and insane.
Yeah.
But it's one that you could rely on. If you see what I mean?
Yeah.
That's my idea.
Yeah.
It's a solid potboiler, but it's not much more, maybe. But
I think I would say it's quite interesting and refreshing in that way. And I think a lot of the interest in this is not so much the mystery of the... as well as the mystery of the who did it, the mystery of the victim as well, because you're presented with this 87-year-old janitor who was loaded somehow, and it takes 95% of the book to try and work out how that would be, who's got a totally bonkers family who I think are... very interesting.
Do quite like a sort of a mystery victim as well.
Yeah,
and it's something he's done before in Killer's Choice, but I think he actually like carries it off a lot better in this one.
Yeah. Was Killer's Choice the one with the girl who died
in the liquor store?
In the liquor store, yeah.
Annie Boone.
Who has lots of intriguing mystery, which he just kind of gets bored of and doesn't bother to explain at all.
Whereas this, you've got a guy who's like, you know, even in 60s America would be past retirement age and lives in a nice house in a nice neighbourhood out in the, suburbia, and has got a crazy wife and an interesting son.
Yeah,
I kind of feel like after reading those comments now, this episode is going to be us trying to make a case for this book.
No, before I heard that, I did like it actually.
Cool.
Well, I've got a couple of contemporary reviews. I'll perhaps pass to Morgan to scan through.
There we go.
So the usual reviewers that you can rely on finding a review by are our old friend Anthony Boucher in the New York Times, and also the guy who writes Morris, whatever his name is, in the Observer.
Does Boucher like it yet again? Or
he does.
Hmm.
What's the gist of the New York Times one, Morgan?
It's not very long, is it? So I can just give you the entire thing. Yep. Unless one counts V in the suspense category, Ed McBain's Axe must have the shortest title of any suspense novel. The weapon is embedded in the skull of an 86-year-old janitor who has been running a crap game in his basement. Spoilers, sorry.
Wow.
The complications of his death make one of the best cases yet for Steve Carella and the other boys of the 87th Precinct. The writing is, if anything, even above McBain's usual level of crisp competence. So there we go. Take that, naysayers.
You want to have a look at that bottom review there, Steve-o. That's the British review came out in Hamish Hamilton edition.
Is there something missing here? The Axe.
Oh, no, he's called it the wrong name.
The Axe by Ed McBain. Blank aged New York apartment house janitor.
I think that blank is just a very long typographical dash.
Dash. Aged. Yes. Oh, I see what you mean. Not aged. Aged New York apartment house janitor with dotty wife and son found in basement with skull deeply cleft. Full stop. Steve Carella's investigation undercovers a network of petty swindling. It takes him into the underworld of drunken bumdom. Bumdom.
Nice.
Do you know what? I've read that several times and that word never leapt out at me until you pronounced it.
It's not boredom, though, is it?
Well, I don't think so.
Bumdom.
That says bumdom.
Yeah,
that
drunken bumdom.
I know I'm not very good at reading out.
I think we might have got the title for this episode.
Eccentric characters include the members of the Happy Kids, a club for octogenarians. Good realistic dialogue gives you a strong feel of New York in winter. A satisfactory installment of the saga of the 87th Precinct. And that's from Morris Richardson, The Observer, 13th of December, 64.
I do hope that is how he speaks.
One would imagine so.
Sorry for my stuttering start to that. I was, I thought it was one sentence.
So it was clearly well received at the time.
Yeah.
And I think that's very interesting, given that I know that the people who made the comments about it online to us love the series. Hmm. And so for it to be poo-pooed by them, in contrast to this very early enthusiasm by these reviewers, is quite interesting.
It is.
So I think they've given a sense of the plot. Mm. Someone is murdered in a basement. He's got an axe in his head. The book is called Axe.
Yep.
the investigation begins.
There's an immediate prime suspect, but that doesn't last very long, to be fair. But
so you mentioned this before,
you look at the back of my book and it's as though he's the main suspect for the entire novel, whereas he's a prime suspect for about half a page, isn't he?
Yeah.
Carella decides he didn't do it.
You've talked about racial profiling. Mm. So one of the first things that happens is this is a poor neighbourhood where this guy is the janitor. And someone who he hires as a guy to chop wood is a big black guy who is portrayed as being, I don't want to say backwards, but I'm afraid that's the sort of word that would be used at the time. Mm. Perhaps a bit, you know, a bit of a homebody. He lives with his mother still as a grown man, and he's hired to chop wood. I hated saying backwards. I wish I hadn't said that now. But that's how it comes across. And immediately the suggestion is, well, he's big, he's black, he probably did the crime because he chops wood, therefore he knows where the axe is.
Well, he doesn't do himself any favour by he gives, kind of like fairly strange answers to the questions that he's asked, and you think he's being cheeky and being a bit petulant.
He's a bit awkward and doesn't really understand the best way of answering the questions, and they interpret that as being aggressive. And
where's the axe in the tool shed? Where's the tool shed in the yard? Where was the axe? It just goes around in a circle.
When I first started reading that section, I was thinking, this is really uncomfortable to read now, but actually it's probably what happens with the police quite a lot of the time now.
Yes, well, this is something that's, if anything, is probably worse now than it was then.
Yeah, it still seems alarmingly pertinent, if nothing else.
We could definitely do with a few more Steve Carellas out there asking these questions, because Carella's the guy who realises, well, he needs more time to answer the question. He needs the opportunity, and we need to give him the chance to we need to understand him before we leap to judgment here. And very quickly, he's sort of eliminated from inquiries. Mm. He comes back into it later on, of course, as things come to a head.
Mm.
But it's...
No pun intended.
Yeah. But we very quickly meet the victim's family, who is his aged wife, who has got paranoid schizophrenia, and he takes some joy in writing her mania on the page as quite extreme and mysterious. They live out in a place called New Essex, which I thought was supposed to be like an alternative New Hampshire.
Mm.
But he says it's only 15 minutes outside the city.
So not really, no.
So I assume... 15
miles, he said. Doesn't he say 15 miles?
Did he say 15 miles? I think he said... Either way, it still wouldn't
even
be...
Even so, yeah.
New Hampshire territory.
No.
So I think it's... There is a place where they would name Essex, somewhere outside of New York, not very far, which...
So it's some kind of relatively cosy suburb anyway, we can glean from that.
Perhaps one of our American listeners might have a better clue about what the suggested equivalent was. We can just assume it's away from the big smoke, basically. It's mock Tudor. It's old world English style.
Yeah.
15 minutes, you're wrong.
A bit fancy.
Well, it's 15 miles if they drive at 60 miles an hour,
which they probably shouldn't be doing. But
the police, they do what they like.
That's true.
But his son as well is a... He says he's not an agoraphobic, but he's a shut-in illustrator who does children's books. And it's an interesting sequence.
It sure is.
Meeting these two characters.
Yes.
Whether you like it or not, the wife comes across as... totally bonkers, doesn't she?
Mrs. Lass's reaction to cotton hauls being particularly colourful.
Oh, yes, she's got the sort of a mental condition that means that she's got no boundaries or any qualms about perhaps addressing these nice young men, particularly when cotton hauls recognises that she's talking in quotes from Shakespeare, and he's done this Shakespeare play at school, and so she says that... that line about why are you in the police or something, you should be on the stage showing your cock.
Yeah.
A big man like you, she says, you should have been on the stage showing your cock.
For a moment, there was a deep silence in the room. Oh, dear.
But she's a sort of tragic figure in the end. because they have to figure out what's up with her, because she might have done it. She's manic enough that she possibly killed her husband, except,
They don't they almost start investigating that because they're a bit of a loss of anything. Well, they're a bit more suspicious of the son, aren't they? And wondering whether he, something to do with hers, caused him to knock off the father. But
one of the clues they get is that the victim, George Lasser, was part of a gang basically called the Happy Kids, who are still nearby to where he lived. And so Cotton Hawes, Detective Cotton Hawes and Steve Carella go to interview the Happy Kids, who of course are now all in their 80s.
There's only three of them.
There's only three of them left. But there's a really interesting, again, like we had in one of the other books where McBain uses a specific real historical fact of war, the same thing goes here. But because he's dealing with older characters, it means he can talk about them being in the Spanish-American War. And he talks about two very specific things, the sinking of the USS Maine, which was probably an accident of the ship itself rather than an attack on it. But that was one of the triggers for this Spanish-American War. And so he's got that real detail of these guys all from a town joining up together to go out to fight this war, and most of them coming back. And then obviously then spending the rest of the rest of the 20th century up until 1964, where this book's set, one by one dying as old age takes them. So there's three of them left, and he has to go around and say, oh, George Lasser's dead as well. Do you know anything about him? It's an interesting thing.
But it's like a bit of a passing comment one of them makes about that makes the detectives think George Lasser's not quite the...
Yeah, he's a bit of a wheeler dealer.
So he's got this log cutting business that he sells the logs to his tenants. Then they make a comment about how his mates had various schemes always on the go, and then they clam up as soon as they.
Yeah, they realize
the detective trying to find. Yeah.
George always had his big plans.
Yeah.
Like, oh, he had this one big plan, which was to run a small-time woodcutting business.
Yeah.
But they don't, yeah, so they know there was something else afoot, and they don't... and is it not a bit long after that that Corello hauls the sergeant in, which is quite a... not often you see in this, but uniform characters getting involved the stories.
Yeah, it's good. I like this bit. And it's very rare that you see Steve Carella be totally underhand, certainly in the workplace.
Pulling rank.
Great.
There's quite a lot in this book. One of the things I think is quite good about this book, it's compacted into one or two moments, but there's quite a lot of detailed what the police get up to stuff. So it talks about rank when Detective Second Grade Steve Carella is about to interview Sergeant Ralph Corey, who is a beat sergeant, basically. So he's out on the street. So he's not like Dave Murchison, everyone's favourite desk sergeant. He is someone who's actually out with the uniformed officers and in control of a bunch of uniforms. And so there's a nice explanation of how the ranks work there as well. And then Steve Carella hates this guy already because he knows he's bent. He knows he's taking bribes. And but his way of trying to find out is by sort of going, friend of mine's looking for some action. And seeing where that takes him.
Yeah.
Doesn't take him very far before he just has to basically say, I'm watching you, I want to know.
Yeah, an interesting character, Corey, while he's around.
He's a racist.
He is. Also just looked into his rank by accidentally shooting an escaping crook in the leg whilst trying to get his gun out of his holster.
Yeah, he's proper Keystone Cop material, really, isn't he? Assuming the Keystone Cops were also racists.
Well, probably, yeah.
I don't remember that being in the short film.
It wasn't a major plot point, certainly.
It was mainly them falling off police vehicles.
He's fairly vile, Sergeant Corey.
I like the last lines in that bit, which says something along the lines of he walked out of the squad room and says something like, he was smiling, but he was worried.
Yeah. Well, that's very interesting.
That's exactly what he says, yeah.
Very good.
Because I'm not even...
You didn't even have your book open.
No.
But that's one of the author's little tricks to seed the notion of something.
So you're like, whoa. So yeah, it was.
He doesn't come back in for a few.
Because the sergeant was being quizzed because Corella knew that if there was some sort of gambling in the basement of this place, then this guy would have undoubtedly known about it.
He would absolutely be taken a cut, yeah.
Now, he was either incompetent or corrupt, and it was more likely both. That he was corrupt rather than not knowing it was happening. I need to ask a question here.
And I know I've asked it before, and I know I've looked into this before. What exactly is craps?
You know when you've had a big dinner?
it's just dice, isn't it? But I don't know exactly what the rules are.
I don't think it's anything that anybody...
I know...
...has played in this country, I don't think.
No, it's a popular thing from sort of, like, Damon Runyon and 30s crime fiction onwards, isn't it?
But, so presumably one of these games that you can just have a pocket full of dice and play anywhere?
Yeah, basically you just need two dice and some money, I think. But I don't know what the rules are. I know, like, if you get two ones, that's snake eyes and you lose, don't you? But
Steve was showing us a picture on his phone of some colourful setup.
But yeah, even though I've read loads and loads of Damon Runyon stories about people playing it, I never actually got round to finding out what the rules were.
When I was young and I got my first computer, which was a Commodore Plus 4, the weirdest Commodore you could possibly get that no one in this country made games for particularly. That's a whole... I could do a podcast about my life with a Commodore Plus 4. But it came with a tape of games that had been programmed in BASIC. Beginner's all-purpose symbolic instruction code.
Indeed.
Because I learned how to program using that in BASIC. But one of the games on this tape was called Craps. And I can't remember. I think it was probably just a dice rolling simulation thing. Can't remember how it worked. But even before I think I knew craps was a rude word, or crap was a rude word, it was like, oh, I can't load a thing called craps. It's just...
Jesus.
It's just someone will come and arrest me.
Yeah, it's such a mild rude
word. Well, it must be fairly complicated because the rules go on for flipping...
Wow.
Is that from the website of the official Craps Corporation?
That looks daunting. I'll never become a mid-20th century basement gambler at this rate.
Well, let's do a spin-off podcast where we learn to play craps over 52 weeks.
Gambling with 3 hours of time.
Yeah. There's a shooter and a stick man. Oh. A shooter.
From what I understand...
Each round has two phases. Oh. Come out and point.
This sounds almost as complicated as
a come-out roll of 2, 3, 12 called craps if the shooter is said to crap out. Ends... Oh, God, dear. It looks fairly complicated.
Let's maybe not get into
let's
that.
Let's move
right
on from crap. Craps. That's the thing, isn't it? Sort of all these things point to there's an illegal craps game going on in the basement of this thing. Sergeant Ralph Corey probably knew about it. The thing that's frustrating Corella and Hawes is they can't get anyone to confess to anything. Mm. Not even to say they were there. Not even to sort of just save themselves from a murder rap, basically. Mm. So eventually Danny Gimp, the stool pigeon, gets a couple of names to Steve Corella. And one of the good things about this book is Danny Gimp, who we already have formed a relationship with in two or three of the early books... We get a lot of his background in this.
Yeah, I love that.
I really enjoyed it. I wrote a little history of Danny Gimp. Sounds like this. Born Daniel Nelson, we know that much. We know he's, in this book we learn he was born on Culver Avenue, which is one of the main streets in Isola. In 1938, Danny Gimp helped the 71st Precinct with busting a whorehouse, as it's called. Because he's a stool pigeon, he's a snitch, and he helped them, and he got $500 reward. Having had a cold at the same time, he took that money and thought, well, I'll go out to California for a bit, see, get a bit of sun, get myself feeling better. As he gets over there, he's having a nice time, meets a man in a bar, and they start drinking together. And this guy says, do you know what, let's carry on drinking, but we need to go back to my house to pick up some more money so we can carry on drinking. So they tootle off, driving, presumably drunk already. He pops into this house, one of these big LA Spanish villa type buildings, and comes out and is immediately caught by the police with loads of money and jewels in his hand. And Danny Nelson, Danny Gimps, sat in the car going, what? And ends up getting a 5-stretch in jail, which turns out to be really useful to his trade because it means he's not lying to other criminals when he says, yeah, I've done a stretch.
Yeah, they went down on a burglary rap and then he just seemed like a legit criminal.
Whereas actually he's never done anything illegal in his life and just listens out and he's the informer. And he always meets Corella in a place called Andy's Pub. So that's been named a couple of times in this. But he gives Corella a couple of names to follow up on this. I think what's really interesting about this book is... It is a piecing together book for the cops. They have at least, like 4 days, 3 or 4 days in 1 week where nothing happens.
Mm.
But they've got enough little bits that they just need that little extra thing to happen. And that's one of the traits of these stories, isn't it? The bit of unexpected information or whatever comes along. So we don't really have any comedy characters in this particularly.
No, not really.
So that's one that we don't tick off on the bingo chart.
Well, because I suppose it's the wife, isn't it? But she's not really funny
more,
without...
more tragic
exactly,
rather than comedic,
And even the character who's called Ali the Shark isn't particularly funny.
No.
He's a reformed con.
Yeah.
Yeah. What about the homicide detectives? There's a couple of stand-ins, isn't there?
Oh, yeah. It turns out, like, the other homicide detectives are just the same as the...
And they've gone on holiday together, haven't they? To Miami.
Yeah, so that's
Monroe and...
Monahan and Monroe, usual homicide detectives, aren't there, and they're replaced by a couple of homicide detectives called Forbes and Phelps, who are just as bad, as useless and wind-up as the rest of them.
Apparently, pairs of homicide detectives always have to be alliterative, too.
Yeah.
So they're going about some crime that involves a 102-year-old man being killed by his wife because she didn't... He's
killed by his mother or something.
Yeah, because she didn't like his 26-year-old girlfriend. That's true.
They think they get the only real comedy in the whole book.
Well, that's probably chapter one.
Yeah, it is, yeah. Mm. They do get this guy, Ali the Shark, Spadino... that they interview is because he's probably been at the craps game. That's the only thing he's doing wrong, you know. But he works in a bookshop, which gives a classic Ed McBain moment is Cotton Hawes trying to trip him up, suddenly says to him, "Who wrote Strangers When We Meet?"
Absolutely, yeah.
And the answer is, of course, Evan Hunter. We don't get that answer in the book, but it's one of those scattered moments throughout where Ed McBain refers to his own work in other fields as well, which is nice. And I think he does that as well in this book with a nice little scene between Cotton Hawes and Steve Carella where they discuss things that they saw at the cinema. And they discuss seeing a film called The Locusts and a film called The Ants.
Mm.
So they've both been off to see B-movies.
Yep.
But I reckon The Locusts is Ed McBain taking the piss out of The Birds, which has obviously just come off the back of making that.
Yeah, it seems likely, doesn't it, really?
And perhaps not having the best time and being a bit concerned about the reaction it got. Because this description of the locusts is, this girl brings some locusts, or some, not locusts, like crickets or grasshoppers or something, doesn't she, as a gift to someone, which is exactly what happens in The Birds.
Exactly, yeah.
But with birds. And then it all goes to hell. Have you seen the film Them?
I haven't, no. I feel like I've missed out because it does sound like very much the kind of thing I definitely love, but...
Yeah, because clearly that's what The Ants is in this universe. That's one of the little slices of life bits, isn't it?
Not seeing it.
No. As we move along with the story, I wrote a timeline of how long the actual events in this story take. So it starts on January the 3rd, 1964, and it is 1964 because the days check out and the dates that are mentioned check out as well. We have stuff that happens on January the 3rd, January the 4th, January the 6th, January the 10th. So there's like 4 days where this case goes totally cold.
Yeah.
And the way McBain fills it up is by having really detailed explanation of all the other cases that the detectives deal with in that time.
Yeah, it was quite interesting.
Goes from the sort of ludicrous, a girl taking her clothes off and dancing around in a fountain, to Cotton Hawes having someone spitting blood all up the front of him and calling him Papa as he dies. You know, it's an amazing way of saying this is police work, this is...
Yeah.
The run of madness that you would deal with on a day-to-day basis.
It's like
a little
montage.
It is a montage. That's a very good way of describing it.
It's like the bit in the romantic comedy where people try on hats, but with more spitting blood.
So we have January the 10th, January the 13th, 14th, 16th, and on the 17th, everything comes to a head.
So just over a fortnight, then.
Yeah. Which... You know, I can't tell if that's a long time or a short time, really. Sometimes
it's bad, to be honest.
It's probably quite prompt for one of these investigations. I'd have thought for it to be fully resolved.
Indeed, yeah.
But as the books go, probably quite short.
In that meet, During the meantime, that's not right. During the meanwhile?
That should be a new phrase, that, shouldn't it? During the meantime, I'll go make a cup of tea.
But they've had all sorts going on. They end up following up, as you suggested earlier, this story about the actual victim himself and how he paid for his wife's treatment. And that leads them down this really interesting avenue of finding out about the victim that doesn't help in the slightest with working out how he was killed or why. Well, they know how he was killed, rather, why he was killed.
The one thing they find out is that he must have had a source of money more than being a janitor could have ever given him.
That's the one thing it definitely cements for them, that he definitely has...
It doesn't help them find out what that is, but they definitely know that all didn't meet the eye, really.
Basically, he's constantly had some sort of slightly...
Certainly at that time he did.
Yeah.
And so, they're constantly just going back and grilling people because they think they know everybody in his circle, but they just don't know everything about. And is it after that they go and grill that Siggy Rowe again?
Yeah, so Siggy Rowe is the other name that they get off Danny Gimp.
He's a bit dodgy as well. They find out from his employer, retired accountant. You see, everyone's old in this book. Mm. This is a retired accountant.
It's his former employer's, like, almost like a kind of good McBain kind of character.
Yeah, he's quite broad, isn't he?
He's not like particularly entertaining. He has his moments. He
goes against type for who he would be what you'd expect of him as in his job and stuff.
Yeah. You talk nice.
But they managed to put it together with something that the son says eventually that connects it. And they have this moment of revelation. This light bulb goes on, but it doesn't illuminate anything. Which is quite a nice touch to the story. Mm. And perhaps this is why people may find this boring, because of this dead end, this huge dead end. They've spent ages investigating this. But that's the nature of police work,
indeed,
presumably. And you couldn't scrape away at that anymore and get any further with it. We need to talk about the ending, really, and...
Well, there's another fracas with an axe, isn't there?
So, yeah, it almost...
goes back to the beginning.
Yeah, it loops back on itself, and we have an incident with an axe in a basement of a block of flats, essentially. I couldn't think of what the word was there. Tenement, that's the word I was looking for.
The one.
What do you think about the resolution? I don't know whether we should give this away, but it's... because we haven't even mentioned... Something/one.
Yes, indeed.
I don't think we need to mention that. Perhaps this will be the first one we can do when we won't.
It's one of these things,
away.
It's like, it seems like the motivation for the whole thing is pretty shoddy, but I think that's kind of the point, isn't it?
Like,
I think he enjoys occasionally pointing out that people commit crimes for all kinds of reasons. They're not always, like, the best of reasons. They're not always... anything particularly serious, even.
Well, does not Sam Grossman give the game away fairly early on where he's trying to explain about something and Corella's like scoffing what he's saying down the phone, and he says, well, don't you remember that people will commit murder in this city for a few cents?
And it's
kind of that, really. It's just there's all manner of what one person thinks is a justified reason seems crazy.
It's a thing that will crop up, has cropped up already in the series and will crop up again, that people don't always have to have some kind of epic, kind of Shakespearean motive.
It's the flip side of the deaf man, isn't it?
Exactly,
it's
yeah.
It's no huge planned machination type thing. It is a day-to-day crime.
Yeah.
And it's petty and it's... If you try and think about it too hard, you'd go mad.
Yeah. Like, sometimes the person who's committed the crime doesn't even really... If you actually ask them, they can't really back up why they've done it either. But I think people do commit crimes like that. So I think...
Yeah. I was quite satisfied with the...
Although it's not, like, sort of in a traditional dramatic sense, kind of, some Greek tragedy and probably wouldn't be too happy with it. I think it works. It makes sense.
Mm. Fair enough.
I agree.
Well, I think we've left enough there to tantalise the as yet axe virgins.
Yeah, so more people can read it and then tell us that they thought it was terrible.
Yeah, so perhaps we should contemplate winding up Kenneth and seeing if we can put our scores into it.
Oh.
And while I start pumping coal into his chutes, I will pass Steve over the ticker tape to do his revision of the last...
Perhaps
you could give us the last five
scores. We've not got the graph to hand. Is the graphical display on
the graphical display is there as well, somewhere, but, you know...
Oh, there it is. Yeah. We're on an upwards trajectory at the moment.
Oh, I see. You wanted the trend, I see.
Yeah, well, like... So, there we are. I won't... we're still talking the high point of King's Ransom at 89 and the low point of...
Till Death.
Like Love, is it? Where's Till Death on there? 69, yeah. 67, The Empty Hours.
Oh, yeah.
Came in worse than that.
That was a structural issue.
I've forgotten what I personally scored 10 plus 1 at, but I think I was on the higher end of the spectrum.
I think you were, yes. You were more committed to the...
What happened in 10 plus 1? I always do this.
That was the one we last did with the sniper.
Yeah. Oh, of course, yeah.
See, I thought that was corking, but...
Very different to this one, you know.
So, indeed, 77. Absolutely, yeah. 77, 10 plus 1. That's in the top...
Very respectable.
One, yeah. The earlier ones, yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Right, well...
Cool.
So who's going first, then?
Do you want me to go first?
For scoring? Yeah, you rarely go first.
I'm going to go first, and I think the nature of this story is that it is solid, as I say, it's solid mid-season fare.
Mm.
Not that this is mid-season in the 87th precinct by any means. Probably the period that would be classed as mid-season is absolutely storming, if you were to look at it in an overview of the series.
Absolutely.
But I would say, as a result of that, I would give this 65 Police Shields. And that's a solid 65. It's not a wavering 65. You know, that it could be higher, but I think 65 sums up the... This is rereadable, it's reliable, it's a good story. You can get through it in two or three sittings and enjoy it. So it gets a 65 Police Shield rating for me. Bleep bloop, Kenneth.
Well, okay.
I'll pass that on to Steve-O.
65, well...
That noise.
Yeah. No, I must admit I was surprised at our listeners not liking it because I very much enjoyed rereading it. Oh. And I quite liked the... Perhaps sometimes I get a bit frustrated with the bunting sometimes that you get.
Oh, right.
So I was quite...
crime bunting.
Yeah, I was quite... It was a proper whodunit, really.
Yeah, I suppose it is.
But with quite an interesting cast.
Yeah.
But then again, not cutting to the chase, I would say 75.
75? Oh, a 10 Police Shield advance on my
gosh. I would say, yeah.
And Mr. Morgan Brown?
Okay, well, I mean, I was interested to see the comments that we got. I think everyone's a little bit mean to it. That said, I do feel like it's a relatively perfunctory kind of entry into the series.
I think perfunctory is a good word, and not a bad word.
I don't mean that in a derisive...
It's not pejorative at all.
No, absolutely. It's keeping the series going, and it does a good job. I missed the bunting, I'm sorry. I think...
put out more flags, Sir Morgan.
That narrative voice that sometimes is so like strong in there isn't really particularly
a
presence
actually.
There, and I miss that a bit, and I miss some of the kind of quirkier characters. That said, I think it rattles along beautifully, and it was very entertaining, and I read it in like a day and a half or something, and it was loads of fun. I'm gonna give it... I'm gonna go low just because I feel like I score highly too much. I'm gonna go for 62. I think
62. Ooh. Okay. That silence was the sound of a very smooth running Kenneth doing his calculations and returning the value of 67 Police Shields.
Well, there we go. Well.
I think that's fair.
Where's that in the scheme of things?
The scheme...
Bottom.
It's low. I will say it's low. It's down there with The Empty Hours. But...
The worst book yet.
But it... You know, that's funny because then...
I feel a bit mean now.
In terms of our scores so far, that makes it look like it's one of the lowest ones. But I think it's more a reflection of the nature of the book in the grand scheme of things than... a lack of quality in the book.
No, that's it. We know there are highs to come. We also know there are probably lows to come as well.
Have we undermined our argument? That's one of the questions. Well, who knows what will turn up when we return for the next episode?
What's the next one?
The next episode is about the book He Who Hesitates.
It's another one that's new to me, so I'm excited.
It's a bit different, this one. Oh. A bit different. It's causing Steve-O's brow to furrow.
I'm trying to remember whether it... Yeah.
Oh, I hear uncertainty.
Well, that being the case, let us certainly end for now and let people get on reading it.
Excellent.
And until next time, I'm going to say goodbye, and so is Steve-O.
Chop, chop.
And Morgan.
Fare thee well.
Bye.
Chop, chop.